Welcome. You're listening to Casually Baked, the podcast. Home base for the can of curious. Thanks for tuning in.
It's a hard time. We had a hard time. Together. Together. Yes, it's a hard time. We had a hard time.
Together. Hi, y'all. I'm Joe, your host and cannabis lifestyle guide. Ever wonder where your weed comes from? And not just the garden it was grown in, but where in the world those seeds originated. Today's guest might have played a part in how your favorite cultivar came to be. Hardy Nieto, founder and CEO of Zen Care Collective and Cora Genetics, joins us on the podcast to share stories and insights from more than three decades of travel, tracking, studying, and preserving landrace and heirloom germplasm. Hardy is a pioneer in developing unique cultivars of hemp and cannabis for patients throughout California and clients across the globe. Cora Genetics developed some of the first international and U.S. federally compliant cultivars of less than 0.3% THC and more than 20% CBD, along with other minor cannabinoids. Today, Cora Genetics remains focused on the power of the entourage effect, breeding cannabis with higher percentages of minor cannabinoids and specific cannabinoid ratios. During our chat, Hardy shares stories of cultivar hunting around the world, preserving genetics, and the art of choosing the best seeds for your medicine and your terroir. But first, a word from our sponsor, MJ Relief, the muscle rub PhD formulated for what aches and pains you. The holiday offers and shopping madness has begun. And I hope you'll consider supporting my small business by gifting relief this holiday season. Whether it's client gifts, those white elephant parties, stocking stuffers, or gifting something useful for your parents, grandparents, or favorite athlete, MJ Relief is one size fits all for those chronic aches and pains. And to relieve your wallet this shopping season, save 40% off your MJ purchase through the end of November using promo code GIFT40 at checkout when you shop mjskinrelief.com. That's GIFT40 at mjskinrelief.com. As I witness big business taking over the cannabis industry, I'm inspired to share voices rooted in the history and culture of cannabis. Voices who have invested not only money, but also their lives to bringing plant medicine to the people. On Podcast 236, you'll hear stories of building community in cannabis breeding and protecting landrace cultivars, and the importance of knowing your why before choosing the right seeds for your home grow. Hardy shares things to consider before buying seeds online and the work he's doing to develop resilient and drought-resistant cannabis plants. No matter if you're a cannasaur or a canna-curious newbie, this conversation will elevate your relationship with the plant, and it might inspire your next travel adventure. So smoke them if you got them and settle in. It's time to get casually baked.
It's a hard time. We had a hard time together.
When I got the place, it was remote enough to where I wasn't concerned about pollen drift because I had property up in other parts of Humboldt and Mendocino County, and all my neighbors were growing, and there was concern about feral pollen drift.
Yes, I heard a story about that from, was it Reggie, saying pollen had traveled like 12 miles or some shit? And you don't think of those things, but it totally makes sense. Especially when you're looking at like one of those global maps and you can see how, you know, the jet streams just carry.
Yeah. And there's actually studies. There's a Dr. Paul Matthews, who's a hop geneticist, but he's followed wind maps for pollen drift and in different valleys and through like Kazakhstan. And we were starting to work on a project with how hemp and cannabis kind of did this transition and how it ended up, you know, from Euro-Asia and then its traveling and how it was pollinated and cross-pollinated and traded on trade ships or just along the Mekong River, for instance. It's like you have the upper Mekong Yunnan province and then all the way down and from the pollen drift that happened over the years. It's pretty interesting and how far it can travel. And it's in cornfields up to like 80 miles.
I think you have amazing stories. And so I would like to maybe start out with how you got into your obsession with cannabis genetics and hunting for them and some of the stories that you're most fond of your experiences.
It sort of goes back to the first legal in the aspect was Zen Care Collective. And that was, we still have a nonprofit and actually still provide medicine to vets and a limited amount of patients. At one point, we had over like 6,000 patients in California. And then at that time, have ET genetics, which is endocannabinoid therapeutic genetics. And right now, the recent project was Cora Genetics, which was the seed company developing the more connoisseur grade, rare, unique hybrid genetics that the current market is like looking for, like the higher THCs, the more exotics, the different terpene profiles, where ET Genetics was more focused on the different cannabinoid profiles and the medicinal uses of the plants. And now it's all sort of under the umbrella of Samia Ventures, because the last couple years was traveling, collecting genetics, but also working, finding these different geneticists around the world, because you would talk to them, but then when you get to meet them, and they didn't have a lot of experience like with the cannabis plant, but they knew a lot about genetics. Growing up in Northern California, I've always been around cannabis. Having family and friends from old hippies and vets, it was always in the backyard, or family was always growing, and it was something around. And growing up in like Mendocino and growing up in the deep south of Northern California in like the late 80s and 90s, you could grow a couple plants, and you know, pounds were worth quite a bit back then. So started growing it when I was a kid.
Now, did your family grow at all?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
You're not first generation. This is something that...
Yeah, but it was my family actually had a bakery too in Lakeport. So it was like growing up, I didn't realize I wanted to be a baker. And when I went to college, went up to Humboldt State College of the Redwoods. And that was sort of in the heart of it, and met a bunch of like-minded people that have grown up in like Mendocino and Southern Humboldt County. But I had been like, you know, always growing up with my grandma in the garden. It was like, you know, tomatoes, cucumbers, and then started realizing you could breed like tomatoes. And then went on a field trip down to, you know, the Luther Burbank Center and realized that like a lot of what Luther Burbank, the work he did here in California, you know, why he chose this particular spot. So that kind of piqued my interest early on in plant breeding.
Which was because you can grow anything in California.
Yeah.
Assuming.
Yeah. Okay. And then being able to cross a certain apple for a trait that you're looking for, or colors, or for a taste, or for the frost or whatnot. And then at the time with cannabis, we were getting all these different varieties that were mainly being grown by a lot of Vietnam vets or old hippies that had collected seeds throughout the hippie trails through all over the world. So it was then finding out, it's like, hey, where'd you get this from? Okay, this came from Vietnam, or this part of Southeast Asia, or India, or Africa. And that was always would just collect seeds, you know.
Yeah. So you were like, okay, I see what they're doing with fruits and vegetables now, and I'm seeing that there's this collection of cannabis seeds coming this direction from all over the world. And so were you already thinking about breeding new and different things from these land race
strains? Yeah. Yeah, and that's what I started to do. It was just tinkering around, and then we started. This was before cloning became really big.
And how old were you?
I started growing when I was like 12, 14. When I was like 16, 17, and then went into college, it became serious. Always doing Gorilla Grows, but we'd always start from seeds. And back then, clones weren't really big. You could, you know, you'd find that plant out of the year. We'd take cuttings from it to preserve that. But it was mainly, you know, starting from seed, going to having to pull the males, selecting certain males in the fields, collecting the pollen from then, doing select pollination so we'd have seeds that following year.
Now, what were you studying in college?
Architecture and design.
So why did you not go into agricultural studies when you were nerding out this hard on weed?
Because it was like the second, my passion. It was like the full-time, you know, it was a full-time passion. I'd hang out in the botany department and go into the lab.
But you just felt like, okay, I have to have a career outside of this.
Yeah. It was more of peer pressure from at the time, you know, it was like having a real job and growing plant, being a farmer, growing up in an ag community. Growing herb back then wasn't really a real job.
You know, and it's funny because I grew up in an agricultural community. And yeah, my father definitely wasn't trying to get me or my sisters to stay home and help out. It's like, get out of here, go do something else. Like, go get a real life. And now none of us have spent any time doing that kind of thing. And now I'm a 46-year-old woman who's full court press trying to figure out, you know, regenerative agriculture to try to shift what's been happening, you know, with our own family's ranch. So it's like, at some point, you know, if you're a farm kid, you have to learn those skills regardless.
Yeah, and it's hard work, you know, growing up on a farm, and farming is not easy, and there's no guarantees in it at all.
Architecture was way sexier for sure.
It was great. It opened up a lot of doors, you know, to and at that time it was like designing and learning to build as well. It was like, okay, I want to build my own house, design and build my own house. And then at that time up in Humboldt, it was like, okay, I could build design. So I started to build grow rooms out and design grow rooms for people. That's when it was really going underground. So I started to use that skill of design, architecture, and then horticulture to build grows out.
Nice. You brought it all together.
Yeah.
So, okay, so Core Genetics obviously is what you have now. So you said you started getting curious about these land races and, you know, and starting to maybe breed your own stuff. Did you start traveling early on, or did you hold off and you were just like working in Humboldt?
Not until I was like 19, 20 when I went on my first trip to like Southeast Asia. And went over to
India. Act like that's late. Okay, and yes, went, you immediately went, started traveling.
Went over to Indonesia and had heard about this island called Uncle Bob that was north of Bali, and it had this incredible, like, this was this sativa called the Aceh. And they called it Uncle Bob over there, but it was like sort of like the Panama Red. It was just this like super soaring kind of psychedelic, and it's like, I want to go find that, you know, on this little island. So went and spent 2 months over in Indonesia the first time, traveling around to all these islands and finding over there you'd have to hang out for a while and buy like their brickweed, because it was always come to you in like a newspaper bag, or you know, you're getting it off the streets from not off the streets. But finding the traditional farmers, it's sort of like here after having to go up into Humboldt or Mendocino and find the hill tribes of like where it was coming from. And
well,
then,
where pause. You tell stories real fast. Okay. So you're 19 years old. You go off on this quest. Who the hell is telling you about all this stuff in the first place?
Old vets and friends that had traveled there. And then what information I was able to read, you know, in books back then, it was like there was marijuana botany, like Robert Connell Clark. and then just random stories. And that was, you know, this old hippie vet from up in Humboldt had told, you know, where I was getting this ache. He's kind of directed me. He's like, this is where I found this. And then years later, went back to Vietnam too. So I had numerous trips over to Southeast Asia.
So when you went that first time, who went with you?
At that time, a girlfriend of mine.
All right, so you're off on a two-month adventure,
yeah,
to find the Ache.
Yeah, to find the Ache and anything else. Like, we had a stationed in Bali, but then from Bali went to like Sulawesi and Borneo, Papua New Guinea. There was this Korowai Kambai tribe, and this was in the mid '90s. So when we were in Irian Jaya, it was like the women were still wearing like grass skirts. And, you know, the men had penis gourds. Like, this was in the deep jungle. You had to get what's called a Surat Jalan, a police passport. And we paid a guide who was the son of somebody in the military, because it was, you'd have to get around by helicopter or Prau Dayun, which is a dugout canoe. So we'd go up these rivers. But there was this Korowai Kombai tribe that had this variety that I had heard about, too. But it was, you know, Papua New Guinea was, it was great to go there, but it was like we brought tobacco, flashlights, batteries, and fishing line and fishing hooks used for trade.
Very smart.
So we were collecting, because we were collecting primitive art as well. That was part of it. We were doing photography, collecting primitive art, and then all behind this, it was to collect seeds.
You were a cool fucking kid.
And document these cultures. My friend at the time was a primitive art collector, and he had a wife in Bali, so he had lived there for a couple of years on and off. So I had a good guide when I went over there.
Okay. When you were on this first trip, what is one of your highlights of that trip?
It was finally finding this island they called Uncle Bob. And it was in Pulaway, which is it's the most northwestern tip of the Indonesian archipelago. So it's right on the tip. It's before Banda Aceh, where the big earthquake tsunami epicenter of that started. But it was this beautiful little island. You get there, take the ferry there, and it was like the huts were like, this is before it was developed, so it was all these little beach huts. We get there and you could start, you know, and Bob Marley music's playing everywhere, and it's just kind of like, you know, a different culture, mainly divers and surfers, and got a place and hung out there, and it was like 3 days. They serve these happy pizzas there. They just throw some like leaves on, and there'd be some seeds in there, and then it was like finding these seeds on the pizza. And then getting the kid that worked there and the chef and asking him about like, hey, can I get some herb, Uncle Bob? And gave the kid at the time, probably was like $20 of U.S., which, you know,
would be a lot of money there.
Like 200,000 rupee. It was a lot of money. And the kid disappears and is like gone for 2 days. And so I'm thinking I got ripped off. And 2 days later, this kid comes back with a backpack and he's all excited. And we go back there, and he's got this backpack filled with, like, and it was all just long. It was swag, you know, just all stuffed into a bag, still on the sticks, untrimmed and everything. But it was just filled with seeds, and it was like jackpot. And then we smoked it, and it was like as bad as it looked in taste. It wasn't cured properly, you know, they'd dry it. And then I was there for about a week, you know, got certified to dive there. And then they finally brought me out to the garden. And this is a little island, and it was like the scooter ride going, you know, going to the jungles, taking this trek and walking into this field at the time, which was like a half acre. But that was a lot. You know, I hadn't seen like a half acre under the canopy in a jungle of all these like towering, you know, sativa plants. And the little old lady that ran the farm and got to know her, but she would like, when you'd see her every morning, she'd wake up at like sunrise and just like walk the island in good health. But she was like the keeper of this herb, and it had been in her family. And a lot of it would go for export into Bali or to Australia. But she had been preserving this particular variety that had been in her family since she remembered as a kid. And those were like the first seeds that I got that from the person that had actually like taken care of them. And this was like when they were using their fertilizer as bat guano. You know, we talk about regenerative agriculture now and everything, and it's like there's in these commercial ag, I think, was something that people weren't aware of. People didn't ever practice it. You know, they were using the native dirt and the guanos and the spring water, and this was back in the 90s, and they had like compost teas that they were making to feed the plants. But it was interesting because it was the first time Touré saw like a male jail, and that's how it was described, where they would select certain males and then bring them to a whole other area on the island where they just keep them to collect the pollen, to pollinate only certain ones, because they didn't want to, you know, seed everything out. So like the whole sensimilla.
So you not only were collecting seeds, but you were getting to see a style of growing that you weren't seeing at home, or were they already having male jails? I mean, because that's something that's very common now.
Yeah. No, it was the same concept, because we do it here, but just seeing it, that they'd been doing it for centuries.
Right. Yeah.
Knowing that to keep the seeds out, and then that was here when it became sensimilla, the seedless, because a lot of the stuff then that was coming from like Thailand and Mexico, they just grow whole fields of seeds, and it would all get cross pollinated. They weren't worried about it being seedless.
Right, because you know the cannabis we got when I was a young person in Texas, you were constantly picking the seeds out. Seedless was not an option.
No. And back then, it was the classic. You take an album cover and break it up and, you know, take the seeds and the stems out. And those were seeds that was like I'd collect all of that stuff. I'd always just collect seeds out of everything, too, and try to find out where it came from. Like when the Thai was coming in, you know, a lot of the Colombian and the Thai would come into the ports here along the North Coast, knowing the different smugglers, how it would go out on the trade routes, sort of say, you could find out where it would come from. And that was always interesting. It's like, this is really good. Like the first time Panama Red, I actually got it from this guy in Ukiah, and he had worked on the Panama Canal. And when he was down there working on the Panama Canal, you know, it was the Punta Roja, but it was when Panama used to be part of Colombia. And then he'd collected that same Panama Red from different regions and how it varied. But that was like, it was the stuff that got you really high. It was like, where did this come from? I want to find this.
It's funny, as soon as you said that, nowadays when we're looking for the source of information, it's follow the money. Mm-hmm. But there, when you're looking for the cannabis genetics, you're like, follow the logistical route. And it's like, if you know and have those connections, man, you had access to all kinds of good stuff.
It was tracing the origin. And that's something we've lost now, where it's like, oh, well, what is this? And it's like, it's, you know, it's a dessert cross, or it's all these names that have popped up, and especially just in the last couple years. But it's like the origins of these and where it's based out of. And that was one thing it's taken time is to actually find, because a lot of these are lost. You know, they've been hybridized and are gone, these pure land races. And it was because some of them weren't appealing. Like that plant that's got a nice big flower, but it doesn't have any bag appeal. Or, you know, back in the 80s, though, or when it was seeded, if you were just happy to get a bag of herb.
Yeah, exactly.
It didn't have a name, or it was just you're happy to get a bag of herbs.
It's a true story. Okay, so you were traveling, you got excited, you found your first seeds that you went actually mm-hmm. looking for, and then, you know, you come home, and do you just continue to repeat this process of traveling and coming home and breeding this cannabis?
Yeah, and then that's in, started in the 90s. It was like with the South American, it was like the Oaxacan Gold, and then like Trainwreck was the first one that I remember where it was, people were a name that was like the Trainwreck. And then then it was the Purples, you know, like Purple Urkel. But that was when all of a sudden it became where you could just have a mixed bag of tricks where you would grow 100 pounds outdoors and mix it all together. It didn't need to be separated. You could have four or five different kinds in there. And then watching that market change. So then it was like 90s when Trainwreck became very popular. We had back crossed that with some other, you know, some of the South African, some of the Aceh, and found a couple of varieties that worked really well indoors and just started cloning those. Still made seeds, but mainly did mothers and clonal production.
And so what did you call that?
That was cross. Well, it was Trainwreck, but then again, they got the name the Unabomber.
Oh.
Which was at that time, we were working with, a lot of it was going down to the Bay Area and Southern California and heading east. And at the time, this gangsters I was working with, they gave it the nickname the Unabomber. But it was that Trainwreck. And then when we crossed it, the Purple Urkel Trainwreck. And then Salmon Creek Big Bud was another one. And that goes back to meeting Ringo. He was behind Sohum Seeds. And at that time, started to meet other breeders within the community, you know, like reaching out. This is kind of, even still before the internet, there was some forums that you could get on and talk about. But going to these different events and meeting these other breeders and asking them, it's like, hey, what are you using? What's the origins behind this? Is it like Colombian, you know, Panama, Mexican, Thai, or, you know, where is this coming from?
Okay, so you're really getting into that world and you're finding your community and working with gangsters. So when did you decide that you wanted to like make this a profession?
When I was working in architecture and going in an office every day and seeing the people, how unhappy they were around me. And it's like, I was like, and I was at the time growing indoors and outdoors and making more money than like the head architects. And at that time it was like, okay, I can make this switch. I'd always been doing it, but then that was like full tilt. And that was when I just was growing full time, started mainly growing indoors and then outdoors guerrilla style. But throughout pretty much all the 90s into 97, when I got a visit by the acronyms.
The three-lettered agencies.
The three-lettered agencies. That put a stop to things for about 3 years. And I didn't take the time. I took the time off, but I was still like breeding and still had.
So you took time off, but you didn't do time.
I took time off. I did time. But I still had grow houses and properties where friends and family were taking care of, keeping things alive for me. And it was like the one, there was the Trainwreck, and we were working on this Panama Red that we just, you know, that I kept within the family and kept within a circle to keep alive.
Now, did you have to do the mandatory minimum?
No, I got it reduced because at the time it wasn't much. It was like 2,600 plants and over 100 pounds of processed, but that was in 96. So it was still that over 1,000 plant count was federal. So we got it reduced from federal to state, and I did 2 years with a 5-year suspended sentence hanging over my head. And the judge in Humboldt County told me if I got caught with a seed within 5 years, one seed, that he would send me back to prison to do the whole 5 years. And that was in 96, where a judge is threatening for 5 years for like one seed.
Mm-hmm.
And then at the time, too, getting busted, I had a couple pounds of seeds, and they tried to use those as plants. So that was a time, too, where it was with intent if you had the seeds. So they're trying to count the seeds as plants as well.
Yikes, that would have...
So there's about 25, 30,000 seeds per pound. So they were looking at like in excess of like 60, you know, just ridiculous.
Ridiculous,
numbers.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Speaking of seeds,
mm-hmm.
preserving genetics. Let's talk about that. You know, you're collecting all of these things, and then of course you having to go away and having other people in charge of it. Like, what are the practices that you use to preserve your genetics?
The ones that were preserved like that were put in my grandma's cellar in a cool, dark place at the time. And then also in refrigerator, you know, keeping it. But the thing is seeds will preserve for a certain amount of time, but every 3 to 5 years, we'd back cross them to replenish the supply. And even still having to do this one, like I call the feral plants, it almost went away because nobody wanted to grow it. So about 6 years ago, we found out it had THCV in it. We're like, we have to bring this back and breed it into itself.
You know, and just as a reminder for us later, I want to record a little video and have you talk about the look of all of these different flowers that you brought and, you know, why you think it's important to preserve these different things, because they all have such a unique look to them. And I feel like in this mainstream cannabis world that is emerging, it's just like everything else in culture. If you don't look this way, then you're not cool. Or, you know, if it doesn't have this kind of structure, it's not good herb. And, you know, that's not true.
No, not at all. And it's like, what are you looking for? And it's like asking a farmer, when, especially now when people want to grow on scale, it's like, well, what are you growing for? Is it growing for flower that's going to hit the recreational market in a fancy little jar or bag and package and be smoked? Or is it something that's going to go for extraction that you want a certain cannabinoid out of it? Or it's going to be made into a certain product, whether, you know, it's a pharmaceutical or a beverage product? You know, they all have different applications, especially when you start growing at scale. You want to choose the right cultivar for what the intent's going to be.
Yeah, for sure. It's like knowing your why before you ever get started. You know, that's important to us as a consumer, and certainly, you know, for the grower, because you don't want to end up holding lots of pounds of things that you can't move. So yeah, knowing where it's going and how it's going to be used is half the battle. I want to talk about choosing those right genetics. If you are trying to figure out what you want and why you want it, what are some of the factors besides what you just said on, you know, what's the end use, but what are other considerations before we choose genetics? Because again, my audience is not the use of the world. They're the people who enjoy smoking and are now wanting to maybe grow their own, but it's not just pick any seed and just start growing it. You know, I want people to discern how to choose the right seeds for them.
Yeah, and that's if the person is going to be, you know, if they're limited to 3 plants in a backyard due to their ordinance and they don't want something that's going to tower over the fence. Odor mitigation is a big one. Could be a choice. You know, some people want to grow. It's not good to grow like a sour, you know, compared to like a particular variety in town where the whole neighborhood smells it.
Yeah.
Or if, you know, if it's somebody that just wants to make tincture for themselves, they're looking for specific cannabinoids for an ailment or, you know, for sleep or... You know, it's what's that purpose, especially for home growers that want to grow their own medicine, that what they like, it's like that preference, you know, what the intent of the use is for the home grower. And if you're confined to small spaces like right now, that's the one advantage of auto flowers. We've seen all big people with their window seals in New York or in different metro areas where they're putting two or three little auto flower plants out on their balcony. Or unlike Europe, it was really big where people would just, you could look up and there's like little plants along the balconies.
Yeah. But how do you choose those right seats? Is there some master database out there where I can plug in, this is my latitude and this is my growing environment? Like, does that exist?
It's coming into play. There's more information out there all the time. But no, it's like zone 5. You're in Minnesota or wherever, a particular zone. Going in, is this plant going to be suitable for this environment? And I think right now people going with they're choosing seeds and they're just happy to get seeds, but they're bringing something that for Texas that might not perform. If you put one of these sativas in Texas and you have the water, you're going to get a 20-foot tall plant and need to have a lot of space for that. So, and that's something working on that with not only providing, you know, on a COA with what's inside the plants, its growth characteristics, and then what zone, what environments are more suitable, or it's more suitable for. Spent last year on Orcas Island developing varieties that were more drought resistant, but also could serve, you know, with, didn't mold. It was a very moist environment. So it was going through and selecting plants that didn't start just after the first couple rains, just start turning to mold. So it was being able to recommend that these certain plants perform well in these, you know, northern, cooler climates. And, you know, some performed better in, you know, tropical climates, like the Thai, a lot of the equatorial varieties that will grow well here, they won't mold, you know, but and let's say these, you know, longer, they take longer to flower and whatnot, but you put them up north and they will mold.
I hear you. I hear all of this. So is it, I mean, I'm sure it's just, you know, Googling it, typing in the type of environment you live in and trying to do your homework that way. I almost, you know, being a lazy backyard gardener, I want to be able to just say, you know, what cannabis seeds grow well in a hot, dry environment and find some magical answer, but it's, I don't find that out there.
No, and that's something that's happened recently, too, is there's so much misinformation out there. And we're going to have to be doing a lot of backtracking, I think, in the years to come, too. And that misinformation is, oh, this performs well anywheres. Or, you know, people that it's like, does this grow well indoors or a greenhouse or outdoors? You know, most plants will perform well in all environments and, you know, in a controlled environment. But you take a plant that's been bred and grown only indoors and you throw it outdoors, it's like throwing a city boy out into the country and all of a sudden they don't know how to take those elements because they've been pampered. That's all they've known is they've been pampered their whole life since they've been bred. Mm-hmm. Breeding outside in the elements, I think it toughens a plant up. You know, it's the epigenetics that add. It's like if you can have a plant that's outside next to a plant that's molding and that has mildew and mites and everything bad about it, and you have a plant that's sitting there right next to it that's completely resilient, just thriving.
Yeah,
that's the plant that's going to perform best in, you know, that environment.
Yeah, speaking of, that reminds me of a recent fire season that you went through.
Yeah. And there was 4 survivors. And that's the pollen out of those 4 survivors. But it melted the whole greenhouse. But it had been working on drought resistant, drought tolerance for plants, looking at drought and disease resistance in plants.
Talk about the ultimate experiment.
Yeah. And it was even the fire captain, he's like, we've seen a lot of burnt down greenhouses. He's like, but usually, and they were smaller plants, you know, and they were under a canopy of other plants, but they were enough to bring back to life and to get pollen out, and then two of the females are flowering. But to make a fire retardant plant with smoke taint, though, is something, and within plants, that's something I think in California we're going to have to be dealing with in the future more and more.
And when you say breeding the plants to be more tolerant of mm-hmm. that, is that what you're saying?
No, breeding the plants for drought tolerance, not in the fire resistance, but for drought tolerance as water consumption goes down and, you know, with dry farming, it's amazing how well plants do with very little water.
Yes, for sure. I wasn't saying that I thought they could magically survive a fire. I was talking about the smoke tolerance.
Yeah, I haven't considered that.
But the drought tolerant, you know, we need cannabis plants to drink less water mm-hmm. anyway. It's a guzzler, so to have the plant in general just become more drought tolerant, needing less water, that would be fabulous.
And that's one thing with starting with seed too, is the seed has that taproot, and that taproot's always looking for water, where clones don't necessarily, you know, clones don't have that taproot. And when you try to pull a seed plant out of the ground sometimes, and if it's been dry, that taproot goes a long ways down. You know, that it's that mimicry of what's underneath is above as well. And that's one reason I like growing from seed too. But on this one particular plant, it went down a tray and the side went down the drain tube into the ground, and the taproot tapped into the ground like 4 feet down.
Wow.
So it was looking for water.
Yeah. Now, is this one of the four?
This is one of the four.
Okay. Yeah. So your whole farm, you lost everything off of the farm, but four plants.
Well, it wasn't in production at the time. But yeah, the whole farm was 12 years of work burnt on top of the mountain.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about what the California farmers really have to do to prepare for fire season. I mean, I don't think there's enough appreciation for the amount of work and stress and anxiety and everything else that goes into that. I mean, it's like, yeah, people are like, oh yeah, fire season. But if you're not here, you're not feeling that intense feeling that kind of ripples around these counties.
No, and that's because a lot of the growing that's still happening in north is rural. So it's going in and it's making the proper clearing. You know, it's having the proper space. It's having forest management, and that alone is a task in itself, is stewarding the land. You know, being able to go in and do fire suppression. You know, do backburns, to do all this, and to put it in the right location. And so many people have carved out these small little niches because they're allowed a 10,000 square foot space. So they're going in and they're clear cutting these small plots of land in the forest and like leaving dead trees all around it that creates a fire hazard. So I think it's really being conscious of the environment that you're growing in. And on scalability, it's, you know, years ago was seeing it, people moving down into the Central Valley and knowing that the greenhouses that used to be along like the I-5 that were flower houses that were abandoned and now that are filled with herb. And a lot of that transition, because it's not really cost effective to be driving soil and with the price of fuel and driving into these remote locations anymore.
It takes a lot of cooperation from the other farmers in the community, everyone sharing resources or trading resources, you know, to make it work. And when you're using a regenerative model, it's easier to do that cost effectively, I think, than someone who's purchasing supplements and inputs for their garden on top of people doing the indoor stuff, and then you also have the lights and the electricity and all of that stuff involved. And so the financial footprint can get really big really fast.
Yes. Yeah, when you're using salt-based fertilizers and diesel fuel and all that has runoff, and when a lot of this is in the hills too, happening in the hills, it goes into our streams, and we've seen what that's done to our streams in the last couple of years here.
Yeah.
As well.
Which is all the more reason that, you know, people want the cannabis farmers that are in their communities to be legal and permitted, because, you know, those sorts of things are looked at, and not, you know, all the illegal operations that don't give a shit about the local community, because most of the time those people aren't locals.
No.
They're the gangsters. Mm-hmm. So anyway, but yeah, I like to share your experience as, you know, a local sun-grown cannabis farmer. When, you know, it's just something for people to consider, to know the history of their farmers and what they went through and how they are now bringing the type of flower and the caliber of genetics to the game versus, you know, just the stuff that's grown in some of those really large football size greenhouses.
Yeah, and it's like use the term like breeding between the lines from the 90s to now. There's that in that period where things didn't have a name, and all of a sudden they were given names, and then the medical market started working with dispensaries. You know, we were doing the COAs and providing that information. The first one of our first clients was Harborside when they opened up, and they'd want to know what was inside of it. So as people became more conscious, and then all of a sudden it was the newest names or the newest varieties. So then it was breeding, like when the sour diesels became, you know, for the 90s to early 2000s, majority of growers, they worked for themselves yet, but they worked for the consumer. That's all they wanted was sour diesel and OGs, and that's what would demand top dollar. So there was
wanted green crack at my house,
Or blue dream or whatever it may be, you know. And grew green crack for years, and it was one of those ones we'd breed it, and then we'd get, you know, have green crack, you know, produce seeds of it, produce feminized seeds of it, make a bunch of cuttings, and then the following year, and with Blue Dream was a big one, for instance, put a lot into Blue Dream, and then all of a sudden, it's like people are, everybody's, and it was a great producing plant, too.
Yeah, but then everybody's growing it, and there's pounds and pounds and pounds and pounds available, and so mm-hmm. Now you're like, well, shit, I need something more unique again.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So, okay, so your genetics, how big is your genetic library?
Across as I have hundreds, you know, of land race varieties that have been collected, hundreds, and of just crosses of those in the thousands. Because you can take one female plant and provide many donors to that same plant. So it was looking at it, and that's how I am. When we started to look at the analytics and getting things tested in like 2009 and 2010, and it was looking for CBD before the whole CBD craze hit. And it was like, okay, what are these plants that are producing these high levels of CBD, and where did they come from? And, you know, talking to other growers and breeders that were getting things tested as well, and then getting plants from those, and then, you know, back crossing to get those certain profiles that we were looking for, like 1-to-1 ratios, and then looking more for minor cannabinoids. And then that was something we started seeing on the charts when we were getting a lot of tests. It was like, oh, hey, you have CBC in here. What's this CBN? What are these other cannabinoids? Mm-hmm. And then seeing that, and THCV was one that's becoming really popular now.
Well, yeah, anything that you call skinny weed, people are like, what? I'm listening.
Yeah, that's an appetite suppressant that you have big companies that like Weight Watchers and that, you know, pharmaceutical companies that are looking at it for, you know, longer term use, and they're, you know, they're studying it right now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so your focus now on breeding, is it to introduce a lot of these minor cannabinoids and create more of a full spectrum?
Yes.
With higher percentages of the minors?
Mm-hmm. Or specific ratios of the minors as well. One in the last couple, in this Orcas project, was actually breeding to take the THC altogether out of the plant, which was, and not only the THC, but also taking the odor out of the plant. So for odor mitigation, so on large scale, you have people that complain about, this really smells. So if you can breed something that has the same cannabinoid, if somebody's going for an extract for a topical and they're not concerned about the terpenes, they're looking at the cannabinoids and they're looking at doing hundreds of acres, and if they want something that's not going to have an odor to it.
Yeah, that would be the only reason why I would, because I'm like, those terpenes are powerfully important. Mm-hmm. So unless you're just going to be making a topical and then supplementing those terpenes right back in, because you know, any topical is going to end up having some linalool or beta-caryophyllene or something in it. Otherwise, just get a good air filtration system. Don't be fucking with my terpenes.
Yeah, but when you start planting like large acreages into the hundreds, and that was one thing up in Washington State out of Yakima, Walla Walla County, they wanted on the COA to look at the terpene profile, to see what the terpene profile was, to see if it was going to cause issues. That was one of the main complaints. And even
but
here
is
in
it
Sonoma
a complaint
County,
from the city or the county?
It's a complaint from the residents in the county that they don't want it to smell like weed everywhere. And that was like in what happened in Southern Oregon too. And you smell it driving 128 or, you know.
Yeah, but that's just like driving down the highway. Yeah, you smell these giant operations where all those poor cows are, those feeder lots.
Yeah, it's or like, right here in Asti, of the one of the largest crushing, huge crush facilities during harvest time right now, you drive by at night and you can almost get a buzz from the alcohol fermenting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I can't even believe that that's a thing. But anyway, so now people like you get to experiment on how to mitigate the terpenes in the flower.
For breeding. But that's one thing, doing that, then you have to have the... It has to have the purpose to make the seeds to fill hundreds of acres. You have to have the client that's they're doing that. So it's like breeding with intent, and that's one thing pulling back recent these last couple of years. It's like, okay, what market are we breeding for?
Yeah.
And more and more, as it legalizes and states are opening up, you're having more of family style gardens where they want one or two or six plants in their backyard because they can legally. And it's like, what do they choose? And it's like, do they want something so after work they can smoke a joint and get high and medicate themselves and just relax? Or do they want to, you know, something that's going to help them sleep? Or do they want speedy, skinny weedy where they're able to, like, get home, get high, clean the house, and go to the gym?
So do you have Cora genetics available to folks like me? Where can people find your genetics?
Right now, through ASG is going to be introducing them, and then online.
For people that don't know who ASG is, that's Alpine Seed Group. Mm-hmm. And where do you find Alpine Seed Group?
AlpineSeedGroup.com.
That makes sense.
Yeah. And we did. We've got our website. We had Cora Genetics and ZenCare, both websites. We were offering seeds on those, and those. Well, it's been over a year now. Those were taken down. We had the account shut down. And we're looking at other seed banks to have provided, recently it's been Making Seeds, providing bulk seeds to larger farmers.
When you said those sites, you had them shut down, you shut them down?
No,
or the government?
Somebody else shut them down.
Yeah. That kind of shit drives me crazy. I had the people who I get my hemp-based CBD supplement from, their merchant services had been shut down and they hadn't been able to process orders for a couple of months. And I'm just like, it's insane the hurdles that get thrown on the track for us to jump to try to just get plant medicine out into the world.
Yeah. Now it's, you can pretty much have pictures of flowers and gardens on your websites. And 3-4 years ago, that still wasn't that acceptable, because even like through GoDaddy, there was pictures of flowers and seeds and, you know, but they just shut the whole website down.
Wow.
They just pulled it.
Well, you've had a very interesting journey with cannabis, and the fact that you're still doing it and still excited about it speaks volumes.
It's been a passion. I've put a lot of time and effort into it, and breeding something, it's like, breeding's fun. Breeding is fascinating, and the more you learn about the science of it and the potential that we're approaching now with the whole, you know, molecular markers and being able to sequence and going into the science behind it, it fast tracks trait development as well. So what used to take years to be able to look for a specific trait, now we can narrow that down into half the time, a quarter of the time.
And I can't wait for someone that you are working with, for y'all to come together and bring us a technology where we can just type in like our zip code and, you know, the type of garden bed we have. And then it's like, oh, you should check out these genetics.
Yeah. And there are groups working on that right now that are gathering all of that data to put together. So it's like, I'm in Texas and this is my zone. I'm looking for this specific plant to help direct you to choose what might work best for you.
Yeah. And then being able to layer on, and I want to sleep better or body relief, and to then choose even, you know, deeper nuanced seed choices. But it's all happening. This is all happening.
Yeah, and the seeds are still, that we'll teach, is still federally illegal. And this whole law that they changed recently with all seeds just being under 0.3% has opened up some doors, but it's still not, I'd say we're still not in the clear.
Okay, you're not the first person that's said that to me. So do you think people should be nervous about purchasing seeds online?
No.
I don't either.
I don't think you should be. I think the person that should be nervous is a person that's distributing large amounts of seeds online. Not so much the people, the consumer on the other end that's buying the seeds. They just have to make that right choice of where to get their seeds from. And it's, you know, with what they want to grow. And most people that are new at it, they want that seed to germinate. They want that plant to grow and flower out, and for them, that is alone is a huge feat.
Yeah.
And to make that easier for them, to provide a seed that you know that is disease resistant, that is mold resistant, that's going to perform well in their environment, it's providing them something that they're going to be able to have success with. And that's one thing. It's like being in this, having seeds is, you want people, it's like at the end of the year, it's where you're like, hey, this is great. Or it was, you know, when we would do events like the Emerald Cup or High Times, people would come back at these events and be like, hey, we got seeds from you this year. We want a bunch more this year. And we want these different varieties. And even after this fire recently, this one here that I call the PAM, the Purple African Magic, this gentleman out of Wairika had heard about the fire, and he's like, hey, I have three of these plants, and he got quite a bit of seeds from me and asked me if he could breed with them. And I said, yeah, if you want to share the information, and this is what I'm looking for in them. And he actually drove me down like three plants.
Awesome.
that he still had alive. And he actually has the black African magic, and he's an old collector. He's been preserving seeds for years, you know, works with specific from Nepali and Africa. Those are his two regions that he focuses on, and those two varieties he's been inbreeding and, you know, back crossing for years to stabilize, because that's his personal medicine. That's what works best for him.
Yeah.
And he found that this purple African magic for his wife, I believe it's MS, but certain ailments, he found he's like, this one completely, and he makes it into like an oil for her. But mm-hmm. he's like, when you see the effects, and that was one that got me excited when we started breeding with CBD and these other cannabinoids, where you see people and then it's like, this works for me. This changed my life. And they're not full of shit, you know? And it's like that change, like when the little old lady comes up to you and she's like, I grew two of those plants last year and I don't smoke, but I didn't, you know, made it into the tincture, and my daughter made me an olive oil or butter or coconut oil. I hear these different stories. And that's like a goal, is to be able to, where people can buy something that seeds and that work for them. So it's like, you know what? I like my skinny herb. Or some people need an appetite, you know, and that was like to promote appetite, mm-hmm. where they can select something that they can grow in their backyard instead of having to go to a pharmacy.
Yeah. Yes. I love it. And I think growing your own medicine is not only feeding your body, but it feeds your soul to mm-hmm. be able to know that you're nurturing something that's going to nurture you.
Yeah. And the plant does nurture. And I did a project years ago with a veteran organization. And it was, you know, they provide canine companions. Well, they were running, they don't have enough canines to keep training, give to the vets. So this gentleman started taking plants and providing them to vets so they could take care of them. And this one vet, it was like, this guy, he's got a dispensary in San Diego now. But he's like, my wife got me these three plants and I watched them almost die out my backyard. He's like, I didn't want to get up out of, he's like, I just would sit down and watch TV and drink and do Vicodins all day, and I didn't like going outside, and huge PTSD. And he's like, I started watching these plants die, and he's like, it motivated me to start going out and taking care of these plants. And then he's like, I watched as these plants grew and started taking care of them, and he's like, it became like plant therapy for me. And he started this whole program for vets, like supplying specific varieties for specific conditions for the veterans.
I love that. That is such a great idea. Well, is there anything that I didn't ask you or that we didn't touch on that you feel moved to say?
No, there's lots of other travel stories for other times, but traveling, that's like, to do anything, just to be able to travel around and go to these locations where people have been doing this for years. And one thing, the gene pool for Aceh, after the tsunami happened, that village was wiped out, but they brought, they call them the Dutch weed, the Dutch genetics, back, and they just started doing what they would call swirling. So their idea of it would be to introduce a bunch of new genetics of seeds from all over Europe, and they just put them in the gardens and they let everything cross-pollinate. So all of a sudden it was that pure Aceh was mixed with a handful of other varieties.
Now, do you still have?
I still have
okay.
that one.
I was hoping you'd say
yeah.
that.
Yeah.
What is your next adventure, your next travel?
That's up in the air. Either South America or Thailand. Ideally, to do the Mekong in Thailand. This is before the COVID, but there's this Dr. Paul Matthews who does hops, but he's been doing wind maps for hot pollen drift, and we had talked about this like along the Mekong, and then there's areas in like Kazakhstan as well where certain hops come from, but doing sort of like an expedition, like just to go find different seeds from the, because even in like Asia, like you'd go from Vietnam over to Cambodia and they'd call it the Viet Black and then the Cambodia Black, and it's kind of same, similar, but just throughout those different regions, how different
those little nuances that you'll start finding. Yeah, that's exciting. Well, I will make sure to follow along on Instagram because I'm sure you'll be posting. What is your handle?
Cora Genetics.
Okay, at Cora Genetics. Mm-hmm. All right. Well, Hardy, thank you so much for hanging out with me.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
I hope you're inspired to shop for the right seeds and grow your own medicine. Cora Genetics seed collection is launching soon at alpineseedgroup.com. Check out the podcast 236 show notes at casuallybaked.com to learn more. And if you're listening on your phone, scroll down in the podcast app you're using to see the episode notes where you'll find links to offers from Casually Baked partner brands. Shopping podcast affiliates this holiday season is a win-win because you saving money on the things you want supports the production of this show. And if you're picking up what I'm putting down, please rate and review Casually Baked the podcast on iTunes or Apple Podcasts. That one small action helps other canna curious folks find this highly responsible cannabis content. As always, if you want to connect or collaborate with me, email your messages, requests, or canna curious questions through the website, or DM me on social. When I'm there, I'm at Casually Baked on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, YouTube, the WeedTube, and Truth Social. However you decide to support our highly responsible cannabis movement, thank you for doing your part to Puff Puff, pass it on.
This is a high time. We had a high time together.
Casually Baked the podcast was created, recorded, and produced by yours truly. Editing and sound design are in the capable hands of Jamie Humiston at PodConnects. The podcast theme music is by my highly talented friend Seth Walker. If you aren't familiar with Seth's music, you can find High Time on his album Gotta Get Back, wherever you're buying your music these days. I know he didn't create High Time for me, but it sure as shit sounds like he did, right? I hope you'll tune in next time. Thanks for hanging out.